Thanks for joining us on Streamlines, your source for water knowledge. I'm your host, John McMain, with South Dakota State University Extension. This is episode 3. Welcome back, everyone. I'm John McMain.
And I'm Anthony Bly.
And we are really, really excited to be recording our first podcast episode about bioreactors.
Well, what a cool topic.
What a cool topic. So what do you think about bioreactors? Just off the top of your head, Anthony.
You know, I think they're a wonderful tool for taking nitrates out of the water, tile water. I mean, unbelievable that we can use biochemistry to do that.
That's a pretty fair point. I hear a lot of criticism about bioreactors. Do you hear criticism about bioreactors?
Probably not to the extent you do, but lots of skepticism maybe, and it's cost, and gee, I got to, you know, maintenance it and clean it out again. And
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
How do I know if it's working?
Right. And so I don't know if you've looked into the literature much about, you know, how they perform and that type of thing, but I talked to Laura Christensen.
My name is Dr. Laura Christensen. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Crop Sciences at the University of Illinois.
Yeah, so Laura works with bioreactors. In fact, I would say she's one of the world's leading experts on bioreactors. I asked her what kind of stuff she's working on, and her answer was, how much time you got, John? Because she does so many things about bioreactors, and it's really cool. But we started at the basics. You know, how do bioreactors perform?
Well, bioreactors work by enhancing a natural part of the nitrogen cycle, the natural process of denitrification. Denitrification, for all the crop advisors listening out there, they'll be familiar with this process. Denitrification is a process we want to minimize in the field, but we want to maximize in a bioreactor. Denitrification is the process where nitrate, which is a specific form of nitrogen, nitrate either in the soil or in the water, gets converted into nitrogen gas, typically dinitrogen gas. And we all know from, you know, fifth grade science class that dinitrogen gas makes up 78% of our atmosphere. So it's not a greenhouse gas, it's just a natural, stable gas in our atmosphere. And so in a bioreactor, we want to maximize the process of denitrification. And denitrification is actually a process that's done by natural good bacteria, little bacteria that are actually called denitrifiers, as you would guess. And so these denitrifiers inside a bacteria or in the soil, they eat organic carbon. And then as they have access to nitrate, they convert that nitrate to nitrogen gas. And in a bioreactor, they get their food, their organic carbon, from the wood chips. And that's why we call them wood chip bioreactors, because it's a trench full of wood chips. Important aspect that is sometimes glossed over, or sometimes I forget to say, the process of denitrification and cleaning our water using that process of denitrification, it's actually a biological water treatment or a biological water cleaning process. Because it's these bacteria, it's these little good denitrifiers that are doing the water cleaning process. And because it's a biological process, that's why we have the name bioreactor.
Yeah, so that's kind of the baseline of how a bioreactor works. And like Laura said, really it's interesting, and like you mentioned, it's incredible, because this is a system that we set up and it just happens. It's not like we have to seed this bioreactor with any special type of bacteria or anything like that. It's microbes that are there. I mean, they're doing this part of the nitrogen cycle, and that's really fascinating to me. And then another question I asked her was, well, how do they perform? And honestly, results vary widely. Results vary from 5% reduction, which is not something
and
you want to see.
Not worth it, no.
All the way up to, you know, 99 or 100% reduction. And the big reason, or a couple of the big reasons that is so variable, one is the amount of water you got coming in, right? So your bioreactor's size to be able to treat a certain peak flow of water. If you have significantly more than that, then all that's going to bypass. So that's all that water you're not going to be able to treat. And then cold weather really affects bioreactors. So let's go to Gary Feiereisen. Gary Feiereisen's with the Agriculture Research Service, ARS, in the Twin Cities. And he really gets to this question of about how bioreactors are affected by cold weather.
Wow.
My name is Gary Feinreisen. I'm a research agricultural engineer working for the USDA ARS in St. Paul, Minnesota. In our experiments at colder temperatures, and we've done one experiment at 2 degrees centigrade, 37 Fahrenheit or something like that, we measure the DOC in the water in the effluent, and it's very low. Then we get the idea that this reaction is, or this process is carbon limited. And when we take the same wood chips and we added acetate to them, they were doing quite well. In the one published study, we had an HRT of an hour and a half. And I think we still got 30% of the nitrate out under those conditions. So that just shows the denitrifiers are there. If you give them the carbon, they can do their work.
And so I want to dive into this a little bit. So he mentioned HRT, hydraulic retention time, or residence time.
That's a big term.
Yeah, it is a big term, but it's pretty simple. It's basically how long it takes for the water to get from the inlet to the outlet of the bioreactor. So an hour and a half takes an hour and a half for the water to go from the front end to the back end. And typically we design bioreactors for 6 to 8 hour HRT. So 1.5 hours is
pretty
really
quick.
It's pretty quick. The thing he talked about with adding carbon, the situation here, it's a cold, they did it in a cold study, and an hour and a half HRT, and they still saw 30% reduction of nitrate.
That's a big number for that short of time.
Right, for that short of time in those cold conditions. And what they found was it's actually not the denitrifying bacteria that are limited by the cold weather. They're ready to go at 37, 38 degrees Fahrenheit. What was the limiting factor was the carbon bacteria, the bacteria that were making that carbon available.
Ooh.
And so whenever they added bioavailable carbon in the form of acetate, well, now those denitrifying bacteria, they're already ready to go, so they can use that carbon and take off. So it's maybe not a situation of being too cold. It's about the carbon being available because the carbon bacteria are the one that stuff that's too cold. So
is the surface area problem? I mean, do you need more surface area then as the efficiency of those carbon bacteria decrease?
So that would be one way to look at it. The other is the type of carbon. Another thing that Gary talked about was kind of the breakdown or the percentage of lignin, cellulose, and hemicellulose within the wood chip itself. Lignin is going to be the kind of most robust aspect of that.
Stable,
yep. And so it's going to stay around the longest. It's going to be hardest to make bioavailable. And so some of the bioreactors that they've looked at that are older, say 7, 8, 10 years old, what they're seeing in the wood chips is it's mostly lignin at that point. The carbon's used up all the cellulose, all the hemicellulose. And so it's not so much a surface area aspect as much as it is a type of carbon.
Carbon quality.
The carbon quality, exactly. Mm-hmm. That was a really interesting part, that the bioreactor performance is dependent on a lot of things, and a lot of the things that we design it for, so like HRT, the amount of water it can treat, all those things are set in stone, but a lot of the things like mulch type or the size of particle distribution of mulch, that changes over time, right? Well, the mulch type doesn't change over time, but that makeup of the mulch, kind of the qualities of that mulch can change over time. And that's something that you start to see diminish performance over time, is that the more bioavailable carbon pools get used up, then those denitrifiers can't work with anything.
So I've seen the construction of bioreactors, and they're very, very simple construction with simple materials. So I'm wondering, do we need a vessel that can be more quickly removed and replaced and the carbon source exchanged more quickly?
That's a really good point, Anthony, and I think that's one of the biggest questions about how we scale these up is how do we really make it easy to work with. And that's another thing that Gary talked about, was developing a modular system that you can even make in the factory, take out to the field, and replace, basically. Let's listen to him talk about that.
The other thing I think would help bioreactors is if they could be modularized, if you will, where we would have an engineered module that could be put on site very quickly and efficiently. The engineering would have been done. They would be almost like built in a factory and brought out to the site and just dropped in place. That would be a vision I would like to see realized.
I think that'd be really neat.
Yeah, and honestly, it allows for a lot of flexibility, right?
Yeah, you could stack them next to each other and design the size and add more modules.
Exactly. And the other thing it allows you to do is experiment with different types of carbon sources. Another thing that people have looked at is, what if you use corn cobs? I mean, we got a lot of corn cobs laying around. Mm-hmm. And actually, that's another thing that Gary looked at, like the amount of carbon that's available from a field of corn, if you just look at the corn cobs. So we can listen to him talk about that.
There's something very compelling about using corn cobs. They're right next to the device. We don't have to take 10% of Minnesota's forestry production down to Iowa to fill all their bioreactors. And I've calculated the amount of carbon fixed in the corn cobs themselves, and I think there's plenty of carbon for multiple years from each acre to treat its own drainage. I think coming up with some efficient way to harvest and replenish that every few years would be a great system.
I know a farmer who did that, harvested corn cobs from the back of his combine.
Oh, really?
So it would be very simple.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And I guess the only downside with that to me is corn cobs are going to have more bioavailable carbon.
Right.
And so that's a good thing, because now those denitrifying bacteria, they, you know, have a more consistent carbon source. But the downside is it gets used up faster.
So we need a module system to replace them more quickly.
Right, right. So instead of lasting, say, 10 years before your carbon source gets used up, it might last 3 years or 4 years. So it would be a system that requires more maintenance, but you would get consistently better performance because, again, that carbon is going to be available more than the wood chips might be if you're stuck with a lot of lignin.
So what's the value of the material that's left over after it's so-called spent out?
So the research bioreactors that we're looking at, they're kind of reaching that lifespan, into the lifespan. So most of them have been in 8, 9, 10 years. So that carbon, the wood chips get excavated, and really at that point it could just be land applied. I mean, it really doesn't have any nutritional value necessarily. I mean, it would be carbon, obviously, but there's not going to be any nitrogen or phosphorus in that. So it doesn't have a whole lot of fertility value, but at the same time, it's not going to be any type of waste source.
Right. You can just put it right back on the land.
You could just put it back in the land. So sure. It could be incorporated as a carbon source.
One thing I heard him talk about, he mentioned credits.
I think the idea of trading credits, going back to producers to incent them to install these things and pay attention to them, would be a good thing. And so we also have some work in that area, where one thing good about this type of practice is we can measure the load coming in, the load going out. You remove that much, you know, whereas some infield thing, you don't really know. You have to go, well, this research study said it removes this much. No, we can measure in and out.
What did he mean?
So that's another big picture question about credits and how we value the ecosystem services that different practices provide. If we think about a bioreactor, yeah, it doesn't increase yields, right? It doesn't really hold water in the field to make the system more resilient from water. It doesn't give back the nitrogen, right? So one way that we can value that, because it does have value, right? It's improving water quality, but we're not really valuing that currently. So one way, kind of big picture, future looking, is that we can value that through some type of credit trading system. You know, you've heard of carbon markets and things like that.
Yes, a lot.
Right? And so this would be a similar type idea to say, is there an entity, a stakeholder, a user in the watershed that maybe can't make a permit requirement because of technical infeasibility or whatever the case would be? So could they support implementation of a bioreactor that we can measure the reduction in nitrate through that bioreactor, and then they get credit for that, they help pay for it getting put in, and then the watershed as a whole still benefits because that nitrate's getting reduced.
Oh, that's interesting. It's got to be a way to figure out how to pay for these.
That's right, and that's another interesting question. So I want to bring in Keegan Colt.
Yeah, Keegan Colt, the executive director of the Ag Drainage Management Coalition, industry-led group looking to advance the implementation of many of these conservation drainage practices.
Yeah, and so Keegan works with a lot of practitioners, right? He's kind of a interface between research and industry, putting practices in. One of the things that Keegan talked about was basically making it more worthwhile for contractors to be able to put these practices in.
Now I kind of focus on making these things as easy as possible to get in the ground. You know, we're looking in Polk County, it's actually a saturated buffer project. We're also doing bioreactors within that trying to kind of marry up cost share funds available. So mixing state and federal and even some county level funding together to help pay for these things. And we're really trying to take the burden off of the producer and the landowner. We're bidding these things out in large packages so we get contractors interested. Basically, we just want the producers and landowners to be informed on what's going on, but they don't have to come back into the office 4 or 5 times. We've gotten pretty good response on this, and it's kind of a different approach to conservation implementation in that we're not doing a full conservation plan. We're actually being very specific that we're talking about these two edge of field practices in this project. And this is in Polk County, Iowa, in 4 small watersheds that we're doing this in. And right now we have over 60 sites with the green light to go ahead to go towards installation here. Hopefully next spring we'll start these installs. But, you know, this is about a year-long project, and we're going to nearly double the amount of these practices put in place in the state of Iowa in, wow, in a single year.
And so now it makes it worth it to the contractor, because, you know, a bioreactor would be about $10,000 to put in, saturated buffer of $3,500 to put in. It's not really worth it for the contractor to mobilize his equipment, get the equipment out there, spend a day or 2 days putting that practice in for only $10,000.
Right. Got to have it bundled with other things.
Right. And so what they're looking at is if they can have 30 bioreactors or 30 saturated buffers as a package deal, well, now that's a $200,000 job. And so now it makes it worth the contractor's time and investment to put in all those practices. So question remains is, how do these systems pay for themselves? How can we make it worthwhile to put a system in?
Actually, now tiles are running and there's no incentive to do anything about the nitrates that are in it.
Right, exactly. And I don't think that's a question that's going to get answered for a while. I mean, I think a lot of things would have to change or shift. Paradigms would have to shift for that to change.
Absolutely.
I don't think it's that farmers don't care about nitrate. Absolutely. I mean, you farm.
Not at all. Right. Not at all.
And yeah, you care about nitrate. And, you know, every farmer I talk to, that's at the top of their mind. But there's a lot of questions about the – well, there's just a lot of questions. How do they work?
How do they work? How do I know they're working?
Exactly. Right. Yeah. And so until we kind of get hard answers nailed down on that, I think it's going to be hard for a farmer to, you know, adopt a practice that they may not trust.
Is there any way to put a dollar figure on value of the performance?
So we kind of can. One thing that we can do is we can say, how much does it cost to remove 1 pound of nitrate, for example?
That's what I want to know, because the pound of nitrate going in is roughly 40 cents.
Yeah. Bioreactors are not going to be 40 cents to remove a pound of nitrate. It would be more in the range of $1 to $3.
Per pound of nitrate?
Per pound of nitrate.
Wow.
Then whenever we compare this against other practices, bioreactors are actually one of the more, they're pretty cost effective. Saturated buffers are really cost effective, I would say, because they require, I mean, it's about $3,500 average, give or take, to put in a saturated buffer. $10,000, give or take, for a bioreactor. But they're both, you know, simple, passive systems, don't require any inputs, don't really require a lot of maintenance or operation throughout the year.
How does that compare, though, to management changes? Adopting new methods for determining more accurate nitrogen rates for corn, whether it be the PSNT test, maybe an active sensor as you apply nitrogen, or some other thing like that.
Yeah, boy, Anthony, that's a really good question. That's one I'm not really sure on. The biggest thing with those is those also reduce your input costs, and a bioreactor doesn't do that. So it's challenging to say, put in a practice that, yeah, it does a good job removing nitrate, and that's what it's designed to do, but it doesn't help out your bottom line any, because you're not reducing your input costs.
Well, to me, if it's $1 or $1.30 per pound of nitrate to remove it, and you paid 40 cents for it, you just added the cost of that nitrate, and something on the farm has to pay for that.
Yeah,
right. If it's not subsidized by society.
Right. And then what's the value of not having that nitrate in the water?
So the bioreactor, in a sense, is like a safety net.
Yeah. And that was one thing that Laura talked about too, was we can do a lot of stuff in the field, and we need to do a lot of stuff in the field. Those are all tools in the toolbox, but at the end of the day, we're likely still leaking nitrate out the tile. So then edge of field practices, that's where those come in to say, look, we're losing nitrate potentially. What can we do at the edge of the field to prevent that from continuing on down the stream?
Sure.
The question is, is loaded with political and market and economic and social issues for sure. You know, some of the farmers that we work with for our on-farm bioreactor network, they really are early adopters, like you said. They are trying a lot of different practices across their farms, and they tend to be real innovators within their local agricultural communities and just within their local communities in general, always serving as a real positive voice for agriculture and trying to demonstrate how farms and how farmers really do want to be good upstream neighbors. So moving beyond that, I think it's going to take more research at a basic level to demonstrate that tile drainage does contain nitrogen. I think at a very basic level, there's still some doubt that tile drainage water, maybe because it just tends to be very clear, could contain nitrogen. And so there's education that we need to do as part of our university extension services and others across the state who do outreach, just to illustrate the point and communicate the idea that tile drainage does contain nitrate. And we are sending that downstream, you know, and then there's also research and outreach to be done to demonstrate how effective bioreactors are and these other conservation practices. I think there's some doubt and uncertainty about how well our conservation practices work. And of course, there is scientific uncertainty about some of our conservation practices too, because they don't always perform the same in every year. A cover crop doesn't always perform the same in every year for reducing nitrogen loss or for building soil health. And so I think there's more research and more communication to be done around the idea of conservation practices and the benefits that we can provide on farm, as well as benefits we can provide to our downstream neighbors.
It's a cultural issue.
It is. And how do you change culture?
Yeah, that's tough.
I don't know the answer how we scale bioreactors up. I don't even know if we need to scale bioreactors up, but I think we do need to think about how bioreactors fit in the big picture. Like you said, Anthony, I mean, we can do a lot in the field, but bioreactors are kind of like a safety net.
And the fact is that nitrate is still in the tile water.
And sometimes in very real economic dollars.
Yeah, there's shrimp farmers in the Gulf of Mexico.
Or not to bring up a lawsuit, but the Des Moines Water Works, I mean, that was kind of the primary impetus for that was cost to treat nitrate, excess nitrate in their raw water source.
And their water, yeah.
But at the same time, like you said, like it has to pay.
That's the way a farmer's going to look at it, because they pay the bills to put their crop in, and now they're going to pay a bill to take something out that is coming from their land.
Right.
And it's a direct nitrogen and nitrogen thing.
Right. And the challenge with that, though, is even if a farmer did every practice in the field, there's still variability and there's still likely loss. How do we value not sending nitrate downstream? And then how do we help that not happen? And it does make a lot of sense to be as efficient as possible in the field. And I think people do that. They want to do that. But there's trade-offs to everything. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, what if you don't get any rain? Or what if you get too much rain? Or what if you get disease pressure and your corn crop doesn't use as much nitrogen? That's
absolutely
susceptible to be lost.
Yep. Yep. Things that we are beyond our control.
Yeah.
So it's a safety net.
So let's talk about sediment and bioreactors. So one of the challenges for a bioreactor is maintaining its design capacity. One of the things that can kill that is sediment. So if you get sediment in a bioreactor, then you think about that. I mean, that's the first 1 or 2 feet gets clogged up. Then
water's not going to flow through it correctly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So not only can it reduce your efficiency, but it can actually lead to, you know, production of things that you don't want, like nitrous oxide and methylated mercury and hydrogen sulfide and just really bad stuff. And so sediment is a really challenging potential issue for bioreactors, especially if there's any surface inlets for the tile system. And so one of the things that Gary Fireisen talked about was, so the studies that they've done a couple studies, just they weren't looking at sediment at all, but within the first, you know, little bit of the study, they had a really big storm, really big flush of sediment that just wreaked havoc on the bioreactor.
Well, in this particular bioreactor, it was put on what I think is the largest watershed that I know of, at least in the Midwest here. It was a square mile. And so even though there weren't any surface inlets in the fields, there were in the road ditches. And so this is a problem. And one of the other challenges with bioreactors or any of these practices is the frequency of these megastorms. And this particular system had a 6+ inch storm, brought sediment in, and it begins to, we've done an autopsy on the bioreactor, and it plugs right around the inlet manifold. It had actually happened to us, and we weren't sure what was going on in the first year of operation. And over time, the water was able to carry that sediment further down the bed, so it recovered. But after that megastorm, it did not recover, and the sediment was deposited immediately outside the inlet manifold.
So that's an issue with inlets, surface inlets.
That's a potential issue for surface inlets. Or, you know, if you have any, like if you have a blowout.
Yes.
And you get a big flush of sediment through the tile system, well, that has the potential to go on your bioreactor, and then you have to totally redo your bioreactor.
So I was just thinking the module system would really be handy then. You could pull out the first couple modules and check them out or replace them or whatever.
Absolutely. I think that's a really big plus for the module system. The other thing with modules is, yeah, I mean, the first, say, 10 feet of the bioreactor, that's the part that's going to have the most activity, going to have the most sediment.
Right.
And so if you can, yeah, like you say, replace just that first 10 feet, that may be all you need.
I wouldn't want to spend $15,000 or $20,000 on a bioreactor and then not know if that happened or not.
I mean, bioreactors do have a lot of challenges, right? They don't provide any benefit directly to the farmer. They're susceptible to plugging or clogging by sediment. They're variable performance, right? I mean, there are a lot of potential challenges.
Yes.
But I'm really excited about the potential next steps for bioreactors, kind of the new frontier for bioreactors. And it includes some of the things we've talked about. So modules, I mean, that's a big potential one. Yeah.
Absolutely. Harvesting the corn stalks.
Harvesting the corn cobs. Corn cobs, yeah. And then another really cool thing, so this is something Laura Christensen was excited about, is the many different potential applications worldwide for bioreactors.
One of the biggest things I find to motivate me about bioreactors is when I hear about new applications for bioreactors and bioreactors being trialed in new areas around the world, you know, on farms or different kind of applications. You know, for example, fish farmers in Denmark are doing bioreactors. Bioreactors are being trialed in Spain, basically desalinization brine, because farmers in certain areas of Spain actually desalinize their irrigation water. And it ends up having very concentrated amounts of nitrate in it. So this is a technology that could work really well in that application. Farmers in Australia and Queensland, Australia, doing sugarcane and pineapples and horticultural crops, they're really looking for solutions to reduce nitrogen loss, which is causing problems for the Great Barrier Reef. And so I get really excited when I hear of new applications. Farmers everywhere are looking for solutions to be better environmental stewards.
And then Gary talked about microbes, the potential with microbes kind of targeting those.
One thing I didn't mention that we have tried working in collaboration with the University of Minnesota, great microbiologists, they sorted through microbes and tried to select ones they felt would work well. And we inoculated some beds in the field, some pilot beds. And we tried that approach too. That's a very difficult approach. It looked like we had some improvement for maybe a few weeks, but then the microbial community comes back to its original composition. It's difficult for an introduced community to break in and thrive over time.
Yeah, I guess that wasn't positive.
No, that's okay. I think all of the research that's being done is very positive because you need to weed through some of those issues, and you got to keep forging ahead.
Yeah, it was really interesting, again, to talk to Keegan because his perspective is, it's not a research perspective, right? I mean, he's working with producers, he's working with contractors, he's working with industry that makes tile and really the people that are doing a lot of the implementation work. And so Keegan was surprised at the farmer response related to bioreactors. Anyway, let's just hear what he had to say about that.
Yeah, you know, bioreactors are kind of the practice that people feel the most uneasy about because it is very specific for nitrate removal, so we don't get some of those other multi-benefits. But I still think it's a great practice because it is such a generalist. It can go in. You know, we don't need a stream corridor with an outlet right there. We can actually put it at the edge of a field where the tile's going down to the next neighbor's field, so we can start getting that treatment back up higher in the watershed profile. Farmers are interested in doing it. Small, relatively small footprint of it doesn't seem to bother a lot of them. I've had quite a few farmers, more than I thought, actually willing to take out, you know, some of their head rows to put a bioreactor in, because like, oh yeah, it's just 100 feet long and 20 feet wide. Yeah, we can do that. That's not a problem. Huh. They're like, we can just hay it right there. And so I think there's a lot of opportunities out there for bioreactors, and it'll still be a practice that people are looking at getting in place going forward.
I mean, I'd say that's one of the biggest benefits of a bioreactor is its flexibility. I mean, you can rule of thumb, put it in for $10,000. It lasts 10 years, $1,000 a year. You don't even have to think about it. I mean, you're just,
right.
It's removing nitrate while you sleep, basically. And like Keegan said, it's very flexible in terms of where it goes in and the amount of space it takes. So to me, that's why bioreactors are still a valuable tool.
Absolutely.
Thanks for joining us today on Streamlines. We sure had a lot of fun today. Hope you did too. If you want to learn more about anything you heard today, head on over to the SDSU Extension website. But for now, I'm John McMain.
I'm Anthony Vly.
And we'll catch you next time.